from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up next on Forum, after gunmen opened fire on the offices of the satirical magazine Charlie Hebdo last year, Oxford University scholar Timothy Garton-Ash urged media organizations to publish the cartoons that provoked the attack. A longtime defender of free speech, Garton-Ash lays out his arguments to safeguard and promote it in Free Speech, 10 Principles for a Connected World. And we'll talk with him in the hour ahead about why he questions hate speech laws, derides college campus censorship, and says it's up to citizens, not governments, to champion free speech. Forum is next, right after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program. Award-winning author and scholar Timothy Garton-Ash joins us in studio for this Forum Hour, an Isaiah Berlin Professorial Fellow at St. Anthony College, Oxford, and Senior Fellow at Stanford's Hoover Institute. He's the author of a number of books, including The Magic Lantern, Facts Are Subversive, and most recently, Free Speech, 10 Principles for a Connected World. And we welcome him to our studios for this Forum Hour. Glad to have you.
Good morning to you.
Pleasure. Much to talk about in this book, but let's sort of establish your credentials first, which are quite considerable, not only in terms of appointments and all of that, but just erudition in general. But you sort of come from the John Stuart Mill's school of championing free speech.
He is absolutely my hero, the English European liberal, and it's amazing how much of what Mill said is still valid and persuasive today.
And indeed, valid and persuasive, as you continue to point out, in more than just utilitarian ways, ways that are useful and ways that are viable. One thing I want, there's so many issues that you bring up here that I want to get to, but basically you say what we need, where free speech is concerned, we need more free speech and better free speech. So let's see if we can define what that means for you.
So that's exactly right. And Mill would have recognized the argument. I say there are two crucial questions here. The first is, how free should speech be? The second is, how should free speech be? In other words, the fact that we're free to speak it under the First Amendment tradition, for example, does not mean that we have to say it. We have a right to offend. That doesn't mean we have a duty to offend. And much of the challenge in the connected world, which is the framework for this book, where everybody is listening to everybody else, is about finding what I call robust civility. Robust civility, not just civility, but finding it ourselves, not under compulsion by the state.
I am all for robust civility. You've got me on board there. But when you read the Internet and you see the stuff that surfaces on the Internet, often referred to as trolls or, in fact, there's a cover story in the New Time magazine by Joel Stein, which I was quite drawn to, where he talks about the darker side of the Internet and how it's created so much hate speech. And I know you have strong feelings about legalization of prohibitions where hate speech is concerned. We can talk about that, and I want to, but how do you encourage robust civility when the Internet seems to be just, in so many instances, encouraging the opposite of robust civility?
Well, I mean, let's start at the beginning, which is to say we live in a completely unprecedented world where everybody is becoming neighbors with everybody else through the Internet, through mass communication, through mass migration. And
that's what you like to call the cosmopolis of
the cosmopolis. We live in the cosmopolis. We've never been in a world where we can see an African-American driver dying as a result of being shot by a policeman because his girlfriend is filming it on her smartphone. We've never been in a world where the Turkish president can foil a coup by going on FaceTime on his smartphone, and that's rebroadcast on CNN Turk. And we're all trying to work out how do we live in such a world? How do we live well in such a world where the old principle, when in Rome, do as the Romans do, no longer applies? And much of this world is actually run by what I call private superpowers. It's not the state. It's not the government. If Facebook were a country, it would be the most populous country on earth. And a lot of what we have to work out is how we negotiate this relationship with the private superpowers, who are in effect editing and actually censoring our speech.
Well, you say in the book the biggest threat to free speech is the covert collaboration between these private superpowers like Facebook and Google and, well, public superpowers.
That's exactly right. So that, you know, the American tradition is the best in the world, the greatest in the world at controlling public power. That's what you've been doing since George III. The American tradition is much less good at controlling private power. The power of money, particularly after Citizens United in American politics, we see it every day in the election campaign, but also these private superpowers. As to the volume of hate speech on the internet, I have to say that for the most part, we have to do what most of us do most of the time and ignore it, because there is just so much, if you'll pardon my French, crap coming every day, every second on the internet, often by anonymous posters. We've all learned to ignore it. The question is, what do we do about what I call not hate speech, but dangerous speech?
That is the big question, and that's a question that looms, particularly after reading your book, very heavily in my mind as a reader. Can't help thinking, for example, about, Rwanda. Rwanda came almost immediately to mind because of the way the Hutus described the Tutsis as vermin and completely dehumanizing them to the point where they were exterminated and you had a genocide in that country. And one can make the argument that this kind of speech that dehumanizes people can indeed render them less than human and therefore much more exterminatable, to use a word that probably doesn't exist. You understand what I'm getting at here. There's, again, that thin line between hateful speech. Donald Trump gets up and says, maybe the Second Amendment people might want to take under advisement. And people say words can be hurtful and words can be used for violent purposes. And yet you don't want any control.
Not at all. That is exactly right. I think the crucial difference here is between the very, very broad category of hate speech, which is criminalized in many European countries, and the much narrower category, which I hold to, of dangerous speech. That is to say, speech which, in the given context, in a particular situation, is likely to result in violence or extreme harm, to use John Stuart Mill's term. So, to take your example, if I rant against Tutsis in Rwanda in the privacy of my study in Oxford, I'll be an idiot, but it won't do any harm. It will not be dangerous speech. It'll just be stupid speech. If someone repeatedly describes the Tutsis as cockroaches who have to be exterminated on the Radio Television Milib Colline, which was a radio station which actually contributed directly to the genocide, and we can prove that because there have been studies that have shown that, then you have to go after them. So to come back to Donald Trump, on all our minds, I think there is a real question whether some of the things that he has been saying in the context of a presidential campaign, when he is now one of the two main nominees for the presidency, is at the border to dangerous speech. What he said repeatedly about illegal immigrants, about Mexicans, about Muslims, the Second Amendment comment, and so on. Then the question is, what do you do about it? But let me start with the basic position. I think it is counterproductive and in practice unfeasible to try and prevent hate speech by law. I think the record of European countries that have tried to do that demonstrates that. But I think we should go after dangerous speech with all the means at our disposal.
Holocaust-denying speech is not dangerous speech. It's hateful, but it's not dangerous. There's a distinction you're using.
I think, and one of my, as you know, the book is organized around 10 sort of basic liberal principles, and one of them is about knowledge and says that there should be no taboos in the pursuit of knowledge. Holocaust denial, which is deeply abhorrent to me as someone whose formative experiences have been in Central Europe since the Second World War, the site of the Holocaust, is best contested, refuted, and driven off by free debate, by good scholarship and good journalism. And I can demonstrate that to you by showing you what happened in those European countries which have Holocaust denial laws, as against the United States, which of course has no such laws.
Though to the north in Canada they have those laws still.
Yes, and the Canadian record is extremely patchy. I believe it is fundamentally, I mean, I think that the pursuit of knowledge is a special case, and I describe in the book quite a few such cases where actually it's much better to get the poisonous lie out into the open and discuss it, for example, in the classroom, in the seminar in a university. I think it's much better that we should confront these poisonous myths rather than letting them fester under the surface.
Which presumably would include Trump saying Mexicans are rapists and that sort of thing, coming over the border to rape.
Yeah, but look at that. I mean, so what is the appropriate response to something like that? Well, we have seen a great deal of public condemnation. Open the New York Times every day and Trump is condemned. In other words, what in many leading Republicans, I'm glad to say, have come out and distanced themselves. Probably not enough, but they're in a difficult position because he's their candidate. Stuck with him. But that degree of public critique of what in the American tradition is called counter speech is, I think, the best way to counter that kind of speech.
What about the whole question, though, about protection, for example, of minorities? I think it was you mentioned the New York Times. It was someone in the New York Times editorial page. I was thinking it was Nick Kristof, but maybe it was one of the other writers who was talking about going home to Oregon, a small town in Oregon, and kids in the schools were not only baiting but bullying and really one could maybe even argue, although it sounds like too harsh a word, persecuting Latino kids and saying, you know, build the wall and all these kinds of things, but also, you know, your parents are rapists and these kinds of things. It becomes very toxic, this kind of speech, and it has a toxic effect. It has an effect that can really hurt people.
I think that is exactly right. And if any candidate ever called for counter speech, for the demand for robust civility, in recent times, it is clearly Donald Trump. We face the same problem, by the way, in Europe with populist left, right and center using language which one had thought gone and one had hoped gone for good from the language of European public debate. But if you take the position that, for example, France or to some extent Canada takes and just say ban it, then you have to look at the record of trying to ban it. And that record is not very good. As I put it, the record of trying to enforce civility by the state, by law, is very poor indeed. There's actually probably more racist hate speech in France, which has a massive hate speech laws, than there is in the United States. So I think on balance, the First Amendment tradition holds up well in that respect. Not in all respects, but in that one.
If you've just joined us, we're talking with Timothy Garton Ash. His book is called Free Speech, 10 Principles for a Connected World. And we will bring you into this conversation. I want to touch on a number of other things with you, though. And that we're talking, for example, about when we talk about hate speech, like you say in your book, a turning point. Well, not so much hate speech, but trying to essentially make sure that free speech is not under attack. We're talking about what happened, of course, with the fatwa against Salman Rushdie and the satanic verses. And there's that whole, again, kind of murky area of banning the book and not allowing the book to be sold in bookstores because of fear of what would happen to the employees in those bookstores. And again, the threat of violence was not so implicit. It was of concern. In fact, talked about it with Rushdie here on the air specifically, but concern about those who might get harmed in for example, why did you advocate – why do you advocate still, I guess, making those cartoons of Charlie Hebdo public?
Well, I'm very glad you asked that question. So one of the – coinages, which I'm somewhat proud of, to describe one of the biggest threats to free speech in our time, is my coinage of the phrase the assassin's veto. So as you know, we're familiar with the idea of the heckler's veto, but what we face increasingly is the assassin's veto. And Salman Rushdie was one of the first to encounter this. That is to say, more and more we hear people saying, if you say that or draw that or express that, we will kill you. And my argument is that the assassin's veto, which has a massive chilling effect, and amongst the chilling effects that it has is self-censorship out of fear, but a fear that very often doesn't dare to speak its name. So people say, no, we're doing this out of respect, so as not to offend certain communities, but actually it's lined with fear. So the principle I suggest on violence in relation to free speech is we neither make threats of violence nor accept violent intimidation. There are two sides to it, two sides to that coin, and they're both equally important, because if you yield to violent intimidation, if you appease violent intimidation, you are actually objectively inciting to more violence, because those who threaten the violence see that it works, so they'll do it some more. So in the case of the Charlie Hebdo cartoons, my position is this. I would not have reprinted those cartoons in normal circumstances. They're fine where they are in this small, really particular, quite specific French satirical magazine, which very few people had read. However, when the journalists and cartoonists of Charlie Hebdo had been brutally murdered in cold blood simply because of what they published, then to face down the assassin's veto, we have to show that this violent intimidation will not pay. And it's in that context, and that context only, that I called, unsuccessfully, by the way, for a coordinated republication of the Charlie Hebdo cartoons explicitly to demonstrate that violent intimidation will not pay. You cannot shut us up like that.
This is what you describe as a kind of pushback from civil society, which is really necessary in the whole schema of what you've laid out here in your book. I mean, to get more people as democratically or as whatever means you can to be on board with this. I was reminded, in fact, of a protest I led many, many years ago against a speaker by the name of George Lincoln Rockwell, who was the head of the American Nazi Party. And I decided to have everybody come in, assemble, sit down, listen to the speech, and then get up and leave immediately. And it worked. Now there's a propensity, as I'm sure you're well aware and as you write about, shout the person down. If the person is speaking, you know, what is perceived as hate speech or antipathetic to what you believe, you shout the person down. You don't allow them to speak. We need pushback, don't we?
We do indeed. And what we don't need is just the knee-jerk reaction, ban it. I mean, we now have a problem, as you do, in some universities where student groups representing particularly special interests are doing what they call no platforming. And that is actually denying the right to speak to someone invited by another group of students. It is, in effect, student-on-student censorship. And that is quite the wrong way to go about it. I have a whole section on this in the book. My view is you should invite Marine Le Pen. You should invite Donald Trump. You can demonstrate outside. That's a great tradition. That's free speech. We should certainly do that. But he should be audible inside the room, and then he should be challenged and robustly criticized. It's not an original position. It's a classic free speech tradition. It remains as true as it was 100 or 200 years ago.
You were criticized for criticizing Hirsi Ali, and I wanted to give you an opportunity to talk about that publicly. The way The Guardian reported, derided her with enormous and unwarranted condescension.
Well, I mean, that's a very, very tendentious interpretation of what I did. You know, if one has been writing—
First of all, mention who she is.
Yes, well, Ayaan Hirsi Ali, who, as you know, is a very brave woman who herself suffered under the form of Islam practiced in her native country, has then faced the assassin's veto herself, and is now a colleague of mine at the Hoover Institution.
Faced that in Holland as a Dutch, working with a Dutch filmmaker, Van Gogh, who was shot to death.
Theo Van Gogh, the assassin's veto carried out. And she is a very brave person who I greatly admire. And in a book review, in the New York Review, arguing against her argument at that time, I used a couple of forms of words which were simply wrong, which is a mistake. Now, I don't know about you, but if one's been writing or speaking for a long time, now and then you make
a mistake.
Happens all the time. And my way of dealing with that is not never apologize, never explain. It's to fess up, put your hand up and say, yes, I got that wrong, which I did actually a year later in a public event with Ayaan Hesia Lee. I absolutely withdrew the notorious label Enlightenment fundamentalist. And indeed, one reviewer of this book said, hey, this guy seems to be pretty much like an Enlightenment fundamentalist. At the same time, I think there's an important conversation with which Ayaan and I continue to have, and she's become a good friend, I think I can say, about what is the most effective way of wooing Muslims, particularly Muslims living in Western countries, away from extreme violent Islamism. And actually, in her last book, she argues, as I argued in that New York Review article, that probably it's more effective, more likely to be effective, if you say, in some way, being a citizen of a free and open society with the liberal essentials, including free speech and respect for women, equal treatment for women, is compatible with some version of Islam. Now, I have no way of knowing whether that is true. I'm not a Muslim. I'm not a believer. But I think those who do genuinely believe that, and they now include Ayaan Hesia Lee, are probably going to have more traction with Muslims living in Europe, living in the United States, than the full frontal confrontation, although, of course, that full frontal confrontation must be absolutely allowed without fear or favor.
Again, if you've just joined us, our guest is Timothy Garton Ash. His book is Free Speech, 10 Principles for a Connected World. We can perhaps get to those principles. There are also lots to get to here, including an experimental website from Oxford after Timothy Garton Ash was in Silicon Valley at Stanford, where he's now with Hoover, 13-language global online project, which I hope we can get to and talk about in the course of this hour. But in the meantime, I'd like to hear from you, our listeners. And by the way, he even goes into a lot of philosophy, including Foucault. So maybe we should teach free speech like a skill, like navigation or medicine. Some thoughts about this line about free speech from you, our listeners, where to draw the line, particularly when it may inspire violence or it may inspire hatred. And Timothy Garton Ash is against so-called hate law legislation, but there is a do no harm, maybe Hippocratic oath behind the philosophy that we're talking about here. Feel free to weigh in. Let me invite you to do so. Our toll-free number, 866-733-6786. We welcome your questions and your comments. And again, the toll-free number for your calls is 866-733-6786. You can also be part of the program by emailing us, forum@kqed.org, or going to our website, kqed.org/forum, and clicking on this segment. And you can also tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQED Forum. So talking about free speech in our connected world and this global world that we're in, it's very complicated. We'll hear from you when we return. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We are spending the hour with Timothy Garton Ash, senior fellow at the Hoover Institution and Oxford University scholar. His most recent book is Free Speech, 10 Principles for a Connected World. We do invite your involvement in this whole question about what is free speech and what free speech ought to be and how free speech needs to be protected on the one hand, but maybe ought to be of concern, and what kind of concerns. In fact, I'm looking at a comment here from Billy who writes, what more specifically would you consider dangerous speech? If you're proposing using legal action to limit speech, I imagine the parameters would have to be pretty well defined.
That's a great question. So as you know, in the modern American tradition, there's what's called the Brandenburg test after Clarence Brandenburg, a member of the Ku Klux Klan in Ohio. And the in order to be actionable, the violence has to be, it's a three-part test, intended, likely, and imminent. Now, what I argue in the book is that we actually have to modernize the Brandenburg test in the age of the internet, because what is imminent on the internet, where everything is, if you'll forgive the play on words, immanent, that is to say, the internet telescopes both time and space. Even if it was put up there 20 years ago in China, it's up there today in real time here. So that if you had really active incitement to violence repeatedly made against a specific group of individual or small group on the internet, I think one would want to go after that. And this is where I think the private superpowers, the Facebooks, the Googles and Twitters, have a way to go to catch up with that, because I don't think it should be done by the government. But I think they should have some policies in place to try to acknowledge and limit what is really dangerous speech up there online.
Now, we've had some very, as you can imagine, intense discussions on this subject here on this program. But you talk about something you call, and I want to get this on the record, the ethics of algorithms.
So, when the internet giants just up the road from here in Silicon Valley talk about these things, they talk about these magical algorithms as if these were pure disembodied mathematical actions, almost by some sort of Olympian power. When you look into it, and I spent a lot of time actually trying to get to talk to the internet, to the engineers at Google and others who do these things, they are actually, or they incorporate, quite specific editorial judgments. So in effect, just up the road from here, Google and Facebook and Twitter and other such places, Wikipedia, but less so Wikipedia, we have a group of people who are editors, or if you were being unkind, censors.
And usually quite young and to some extent inexperienced in the ways of the world.
Young kids in their early 20s sitting in front of screens deciding, for example, that we shouldn't have nudity on Facebook. Now, this is a very particular American cultural norm, but this decision is being made for 1.6 billion people, people across the world. And that is something that has to be, I think, interrogated. So I think one of the big points I want to make out of the book is we need, and this is a book that invites to conversation like this program, is we need a much more intensive conversation with the private superpowers about their editorial and moderating, or if you like, censorial standards.
This gets to your experimental website, which I said before the break I wanted to bring up.
Exactly so. So, you know, I was sitting here about 6 years ago at Stanford writing that very old-fashioned thing called a book about what I was calling the post-Gutenberg age, the age after print, the age after the digital revolution. And I suddenly said to myself, if your topic is the post-Gutenberg world, how can you just be writing about it in the old-fashioned pre-Gutenberg way? And so I set up a website at Oxford University. It's called freespeechdebate.com. freespeechdebate.com. I hope your listeners will come on and have a look, which is an amazing resource for the discussion of all these issues around free speech worldwide. It's in 13 languages, Hindi, Farsi, Urdu, Arabic, Russian, Chinese, you name it.
Boy, you added some. I thought it was, last I looked, it was 13.
13.
Up to 30.
No, 13. 13, sorry. That's just my English accent. No, 13. 13. No, 30. I mean, that's demanding enough. I have this amazing group of mainly graduate students who are native speakers of all these languages. And the very simple act of translation is so revealing. So let me give you one quick example. My very simple liberal universal principle for discussion on religion is we respect the believer, but not necessarily the content of the belief. A classic liberal position, which I argue is essential for combining free speech and freedom of religion in a multicultural society, in a city like San Francisco, where there are people from every culture and religion. Now, when you get to translate that into 12 other languages, you discover that in Arabic, in Farsi, in Urdu, even in Turkish, it's quite difficult to find the generic term for the believer, i.e. the believer in all faiths or none. Because, like us in the 19th century, where the believer was the believer in Christianity, the most commonly used word is for the believer in Islam, as opposed to the infidel. So in the very moment of translation, you discover something really important about the transcultural conversation on free speech.
Again, our guest, Timothy Garton-Ash. Let's hear from you, our listeners, and you can join us not only by phone at our toll-free number, 866-733-6786, but by email, forum@kqed.org, or tweet us. Our Twitter handle's @KQEDForum. Tweeting us, you can make those private superpowers even more acquainted with your consumption. You can also, by the way, join us by going to our website, kqed.org/forum. Let's go to your calls. Let's begin, Joshua, with you. Morning. My calls are not engaging. We're going to have to get somebody in here to rectify this. This happened in the last hour as well. We've got a full board of calls, and I'm hoping that we can get somebody to bail us out of this and rescue us. In the meantime, let me go to some comments. Paul writes, does your guest today have a response to the Gawker ruling that's just come out where a judge fined Gawker $140 million in privacy damages for publishing a video of Hulk Hogan having sex? You know about this story. It involved Peter Thiel, who put up the money for that.
Indeed, I do. And I do have a response to it, which is, let me step back for a moment. One of the most fundamental characteristics of the Internet is it makes it easier to make things public and more difficult to keep them private. That's an absolutely essential characteristic of the whole Internet. Therefore, to manage in this new connected world, we need to think very carefully about defending privacy. So I believe that is something very important, and I have every sympathy with Peter Thiel, who was, of course, the financier of the court case.
Financier because he was outed by Gawker as homosexual.
Because he was outed. Now, was it right that he was outed? I think absolutely not. I think there has to be, this is a old, familiar argument, but nonetheless a good one, there has to be a genuine public interest for such an invasion of somebody's privacy.
So it's better to out someone who is hypocritically opposed to, for example, gay lesbian legislation.
Exactly. Yeah. For example, so the famous case of Christine O'Donnell, for example. Mm-hmm. Now, Gawker absolutely pushed the frontiers. And actually, I quote in the book Nick Denton, a compatriot of mine, a British journalist, who initially cited the public interest for exposing the fact that Christine O'Donnell had a one-night stand with a guy while she was preaching abstinence from everything, including, if memory serves, masturbation, heavens above. Initially, he cited the public interest, and then he said, actually, you know, I was wrong to quote the public interest. We just thought this was an interesting story, and we thought it would interest you, right? We thought it was funny, and we thought you would think it was funny. So he was absolutely pushing the limits, and I think it is good that somebody pushed back and that limits were shown to Gawker, because I think the invasions of privacy, which, by the way, now extend to, you know, teenage girls in the case of revenge porn and posting of naked pictures of them and so on and so forth. I mean, lives are ruined by this stuff. We need to push back against that. I'm less enthusiastic about the idea that because someone is a billionaire, they can actually bankrupt, take Gawker out of business. That, I think, is problematic, but it's a different problem. It's a problem of the power of money.
Well, it could be theoretically done to virtually any newspaper. Or, in fact, Trump, since we've mentioned him a few times, has been threatening to take the license away from the New York Times and the Washington Post because he said they're, you know, spreading mendacity or whatever it is.
So I think you've got a really interesting subject here, which is the media in this presidential election. I mean, you know, somehow they are not delivering what the media are meant to deliver in a democracy, which is a genuine public sphere like the ancient Athenian Pnyx, where we hear all conflicting points of view and arguments of the evidence and the arguments.
This is what we do daily, by the way, not to sound self-serving, but it's certainly what we try to do in public radio.
Absolutely you do, and you have no greater fan of NPR than I am, or indeed the BBC in Britain. The problem is, and actually my colleagues at Stanford, Douglas Rivers and David Brady, have done some really interesting work on this, that we now know that the Trump voters and the Clinton voters are living in two different media universes. Mm-hmm. Almost no Trump voters, according to Rivers and Brady's research with YouGov, almost no Trump voters get their political news from national newspapers, right? So the New York Times can be as fair and balanced as it can possibly be, but it's not going to get to the Trump voters. They listen to talk radio. They listen to Fox News.
The Enquirer, we found out recently, too.
Right, exactly. And something very interesting follows in this, if I may, because I think it's a really interesting point, which is how in a country which has the greatest free press tradition of any country in the world, you're losing the genuine public sphere that you need for democracy. Because at the same time, you know, the Clinton voters are in one universe, the Trump voters are in another. So for decades, something which is called the Faith hypothesis, after Ray Faith, namely, it's the economy, stupid. Ultimately, it's the condition of the economy decides the election. Now, what happens over the last decade or so? The polling evidence shows, and the focus group evidence shows, that Democrats and Republicans are now living in two different economies. That is to say, they see two different economies because the story they're told by their partisan media of left or of right is so persuasive that it trumps the facts.
So to speak.
Indeed. Well, I mean, as you know, there's an old English word, trumpery, which wonderfully means nonsense and fraud and trickery.
Again, if you've just joined us, our guest is Timothy Garton-Ash. His book is Free Speech, 10 Principles for a Connected World. I believe now that we can get to our callers, thanks to our ace engineer who's back there in the control room controlling things. Paul, you're our first caller. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I like Timothy's point of view on this. Incitement to violence is something, if it's successful, I think there should be consequences. It's okay to have free speech, and we want to encourage free speech. But if that free speech incites violence and is successful inciting violence, then there should be consequences. For instance, now we have this new television series called Copycat Killers, which very clearly demonstrates that people exposed to certain media will take that suggestion and act upon it. And in today's very intense media, television, but especially the movies and so on, as Marshall McLuhan said, the medium is the massage, and we shouldn't give people a pass saying that everybody has the ability to control themselves in spite of the intensity of that massage. One of the examples I give is somebody who's drunk and does something that is something that they would normally not do, but we give them a pass saying, oh, well, you're drunk, so you don't have to be responsible.
Okay, let me just cut to the chase here, Paul, and thank you for the call. I mean, there are a lot of these arguments that people are influenced by media, they do copycat. Again, you get into this difficult area of what can influence people and how much it has to be interceded with or has to be monitored or has to be essentially controlled.
So,
especially where children are concerned. So, I mean, the argument always gets there.
First of all, I agree with you very much that the really vital line to draw is the line that is about violence and incitement to violence. That is already much more tightly drawn than the much broader category of hate speech. So then the question becomes, how do you establish what is actually dangerous? What is really dramatically increasing the probability of violence? And that's much more difficult in the connected world we live in today. The criterion cannot be what one single unbalanced mind might make of this. So, for example, the Norwegian mass murderer Anders Behring Breivik, who was actually an anti-Islamic fanatic, was radicalized, we know, by feeding his fevered mind on some extreme anti-Islam websites like Atlas Shrugged's Pamela Geller. Now, the fact that one unbalanced mind then went off and committed mass murder cannot be enough to say we should ban those sites.
What about
that can't be the criteria.
Do you remember all the arguments, though, about Judas Priest and, you know, the Satanism and propagating those kinds of ideas? In other words, the argument was that they were polluting, especially young minds, and they were having a serious deleterious effect on those young minds, leading them toward anarchy, violence, all kinds of behavior that was absolutely unacceptable in any social sense.
So I think that's exactly right. And therefore, what you have to do is to look at the evidence and see where the evidence leads. So that, you, for example, with video games, there's actually quite a lot of serious study of what is the effect of bang-bang video games. And for most people, most of the time, you know, our children, most of the time, bang-bang videos don't have any deleterious effect. So that, I mean, to the caller, let's agree that we draw the line at violence. Let's look at the evidence. Let's establish what is dangerous speech in a particular context. And then, yes, we have to go after it.
Establish it by consensus? Is that the only way to establish it?
By trying to see where there is cause and effect.
But sometimes it's very difficult to measure.
Which is, it is very, very difficult indeed.
But
also, I mean, one thing that really struck me in my work on this book, which went over many years, was how little really good work is done on trying to establish the causal connection between for certain kinds of extreme speech and violence, for example. And I think we need much more evidence-based work. And I think the Googles and the Twitters and Facebook, who, as we know, are as rich as Croesus, should be amongst those putting a lot more money and resources into investigating that. It's a real challenge, and I don't for a moment pretend there's an easy answer. By the way, I misspoke. The political scientist was called not Faith, but Fair, ironically enough.
And I hope the Croesuses are listening. Let me go to another caller. Dan, you're on.
Yes, hello. As everyone knows, in the U.S., we have the First Amendment, which Europe's teens don't have the same kind of amendment. I want to make something really clear. I'm not sure if it was made clear that the First Amendment does not apply to things like Facebook. So as far as government restriction of speech, it is very much in line with what your guest is talking about. You really got to be able to draw a clear, direct relationship between the speech and imminent violence. We're talking imminent. Consequently, we really protect pretty much everything as far as what the government can do. The real problem, I think, by the way, that's a legal tradition that's been going on for over 100 years. No sign that it's going to change. The real problem, of course, is a lot of these rules being done in public universities, private universities, on Facebook. They don't have to abide by the First Amendment. To some degree, public universities do, but they have more leeway. That's where you see a lot of curtailing of speech, and I'd like your guest to address that.
Okay. Timothy Gardner.
So that's exactly right. And in the case of the internet platforms, there is a little provision, which is Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act, which allows the Googles and Facebooks and Twitters not to have intermediary liability. So you're absolutely correct on the legal point. And where they do have liability, for example, in relation to child pornography or paedophilia, they very, very rigorously go after this stuff. That's why I argue, and it's one of the main points of the book, we need a conversation amongst ourselves in civil society and with these big communications companies about what they should do, because they think it's the right thing to do, because they recognize the speech is dangerous, even though the law does not prevent them doing it and should not prevent them doing it. Okay? Now, come to universities. I mean, I work in two great universities, Oxford and Stanford, and I think in principle it is absolutely right that great universities should be able to set their own terms for debate. And those should be terms of robust civility. You know, it isn't the hustings on the marketplace. It isn't the pub. It's a university. Everyone should be allowed to be heard and then civilly but forcefully rebutted. So what worries me is not certain rules for debate, because you and I both have them in our university. Not everyone can speak at once, to me, but take the simplest rule. It is where the effect is actually to exclude and ban certain speakers or points of view.
Apropos of that, I want to read a comment from a listener here that's right on point, although I must say that there is a sense of the media being favoring even and leaning toward, I mean the commercial media largely, of course, contentiousness and discourse that is simply antipathetic to what you're talking about as robust civility. I mean, people get on Fox TV and they yell at each other, and you can't even necessarily even discern what they're saying because they're yelling at each other. This has become, to some extent, the norm, but that's enough editorializing for me. I want to read you a comment from Walter, who writes, "When I was in college, the person who arranged campus speakers had a penchant for selecting speakers with extreme views, such as the leader of the KKK, the leader of the Communist Party, etc." This is, goes back to what I was talking about, organizing a demonstration against George Lincoln Rockwell many years ago. "Today, such speakers might be banned from campus. Even though I strongly disagreed with them, I was glad they were invited. Some of the students who went to hear these people were not aware such extreme views even existed, and the speakers did not convert anyone, as far as I know." There you have it.
You have it, and you're 100% right. That is entirely my view. For example, the French National Front leader Marine Le Pen was invited to speak at the Oxford Union, the Oxford Student Debating Society, and far from being a great publicity coup for her, she was so effectively grilled by the other debaters and by the students, actually, that on the whole she got negative publicity back in France. And that's what we do. That's what we do in England. That's what we do in the United States.
And that's what we try to do here on our program. Again, not to stop, but, you know, you're at Hoover, and when I started out here back in the early 90s, there were people who said, how can you put somebody from Hoover? I mean, I actually heard this when I started this program. You put somebody on from Hoover because, you know, they're so conservative and so forth. This is a public radio station. You should be putting on only liberals. I did this morning. Well, we did this morning with Timothy. But the fact is, you know, if you don't want to hear what people have to say whose ideas are against yours, then how can you rebut them? How can you go against them?
I mean, that is so obviously right. But can I add to that, to go to your editorializing comment about privileging shouting on the good journalistic motto that if it bleeds, it leads? We actually need, and this goes back to my point about the public sphere, media which Trump supporters and Clinton supporters, Republicans and Democrats, left and right, liberals and conservatives, all listen to and read, in which all points of view are represented. I mean, this is the classic ideal, and when I say classic, it goes back to ancient Athens, of free speech.
It's becoming, isn't it becoming more siloed, though? I mean, you have more people who want to watch Fox watch Fox, people want to watch MSNBC watch MSNBC.
This is exactly my point, and I think your point, that what we've already observed on the internet, which is a tendency to go off in information cocoons, echo chambers where you only hear your views played back to you, your Facebook page where you have your Facebook friends. By the way, there's really interesting research which shows that people are much more likely to post really extreme racist views on Facebook than on Twitter. Why? Because on Facebook they think these are their friends who think the same as them. Twitter, everyone knows it's a public platform. The problem is that we're losing that shared space where everyone is confronted with the range of views. And I actually think, to come back to the American broadcasting media, that the loss of the fairness doctrine in the 1980s, as you remember, under the Reagan administration, when, who was it? I think the guy who was implementing it said that television is just a toaster with pictures. That, I think, has had very damaging consequences for American democracy, the loss of that public sphere. We in Britain are slightly more fortunate, and actually Canada too and Germany too, for example, because we do have really strong public service broadcasting You know, in Britain, when you get up in the morning, the equivalent of your show is the BBC Radio 4's Today programme. 7 million people listen. That's an awful lot of people in a small country. And you get all those competing views. And I know that's what NPR aspires to. But the trouble is, arguably, the listenership, the audience, is itself often a silo.
It's a high bar, but we do aspire to it. And I think you've expressed it quite well. Maybe we've got like seconds left here. Top principle of your 10 principles. What's right at the top?
So actually at the top of the 10, and of course I hope everyone goes on the website and buys the book, is we all human beings must be free and able to express ourselves and to seek, receive, and impart information and ideas regardless of frontiers. That's my restatement of Article 19. But if you ask me what's the most urgent and pressing one, it's been a great subject of our conversation. We neither make threats of violence nor accept violent intimidation. That's a line we have to hold.
Ah, it goes all back to the Ten Commandments in some ways, like Mosaic law. Timothy Garnett, pleasure to have you with us this hour. Thank you so much for joining us.
A pleasure.
The book, Free Speech, 10 Principles for a Connected World. And we are here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, with an hour repeated, 10 to 11 in the evening tomorrow. In this 10 o'clock hour, we're going to talk about the Mayan civilization, and we're going to go exploring, actually, through the world of the Mayans. Please join us for that. Richard Carlson will be joining us. William Carlson, excuse me, local writer and historian, archaeologist, actually. Thank you for joining us for today's program. Forum is produced by Judy Campbell, Irene Noguchi, Tina Lauerberg, and Susan Britton. Our engineer is Howard Gelman. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll, and our general manager is Joanne Wallace. And for all of us here at KQED, I thank you for listening. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.